This is Robin Farmer for this edition of The Writer's Voice for Virginia Voice. And today's guest is Patricia A. Smith, who will talk about her debut novel, The Year of Needy Girls, which one reviewer summed up this way. This contemporary witch hunt north of Boston is a collision of the Children's Hour and Mystic River. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about your work, let me tell listeners a little more about you. An educator for 32 years, Patricia Smith has been teaching American literature and creative writing at the Appomattox Regional Governor's School in Petersburg since 2006. A native New Englander, she received her MFA from Virginia Commonwealth University. Her nonfiction has appeared in the anthologies One Teacher in Ten, Gay and Lesbian Educators Tell Their Stories, Tied in Knots, Funny Stories from the Wedding Day, and Something to Declare, Good Lesbian Travel Writing, among others. Her work has also appeared in such places as Salon, Broad Street, a new magazine of true stories, and an online journal of literature, culture, and the arts. Smith's debut novel, The Year of Needy Girls, is a tense story about a small town swept up in bigotry and paranoia after the brutal murder of a local boy sends the residents into a frenzied witch hunt. Bear with me as I read one more review that made me smile as I felt like I wrote it. The story immediately draws the reader in and keeps you wondering about how the various plot lines will intersect and resolve. The characters are real, very likable, but also flawed. You find yourself cheering them on while also wanting to sit them down and give them advice like you're their best friend. The imagery is great. Details about the weather, for example, paint pictures with words, with some sentences you just want to reread for their ability to perfectly describe something you have personally experienced. A great book that leaves me wanting to know what happens next in the characters' lives. Sequel, please. You like that?
I do. Thank you for that.
Talk about how you came up with the idea for the novel. It was based on something that actually happened.
That's right. I was teaching in Cambridge at the time, and there was a young boy who was abducted by his next-door neighbor. He was sexually molested, and he was murdered. I was teaching fifth and sixth grade at the time, and all my students knew this young boy. And obviously, it was horrific. It was a horrific crime. It really threw us all into panic mode, mostly because, much like in this book, he had gotten in the car with this man, and my students said, we know we're not supposed to get in the car with strangers, but he wasn't a stranger. So there was a lot of fear, and this stayed in my mind for a really long time, this really horrible story. And also, the LGBT community at the same time, there was a lot of fear around this incident because we wondered if it would turn into some kind of a witch hunt, right, for teachers and other adults who are working with young children. It didn't, luckily. But I kept that question in my head, what if? What if it hadn't turned out the way it did?
Can you talk about some of the themes that you explored and why they're especially timely now?
I was living in Cambridge at the time. And as many of you probably know, Cambridge is notoriously liberal, or it's known as being a notoriously liberal city. But I also was interested in the idea of that facade of liberalness where people sort of appear to be one thing, but really, in fact, deep down are something else. And so I wanted to explore that. And I also wanted to explore that false sense of other, I guess, where everyone thinks the way that somebody else lives is either better or worse, right? So both Deirdre and SJ, her partner, are deluded in the ways that they see the world. So I wanted to explore that too. And then certainly the intolerance that unfortunately seems to be rearing its head again is something I also wanted to look at explicitly. What happens when people let their fears run their lives and let their intolerance take over? What happens?
So what kind of reaction are you getting from readers?
Really positive, a really positive reaction. And it's interesting, too, because when I started out, I really was thinking about how homophobia tears apart both a family and a town. And I ended up focusing more on the town, I guess, than the family, although certainly Deirdre's relationship is affected, right? But people have also told me there's so much in here about teaching and just teaching in general that they are loving that. And they love the idea that while the two characters, the two main characters are lesbians, it isn't necessarily about being gay. You know, that just happens to be a fact and it does factor into the reaction that they get in the town. But it's also just a fact of their lives and it's just something else interesting about them maybe, but it isn't the main thing about them.
So can you read an excerpt for us?
Sure. Now, I thought I would read the opening scene, which doesn't involve the two main characters, but sets the scene for the whole book. And this is the very, very beginning of the book. The air, electric, buzzes and hums. It's the end of August, one of those humid, still Saturdays, the city empty or holding its breath. East of the river, near the abandoned textile mill and the old shoe warehouse, Leo Rivera rides his bicycle, a 10-speed hand-me-down from his brothers. He pays no mind to the heat. Leo stands and pumps past a vacant lot, one of several in his neighborhood, littered with broken glass that sparkles in the sun. Tufts of stiff, burnt grass poke through cracks in the concrete, and red plastic milk crates sit overturned and empty in the lot, waiting for the men who will gather there later to drink beer and listen to the game. Through the opened window of a shingled brown triple-decker, he hears Portuguese, the same radio station his mother listens to, the same one that will broadcast the soccer match this afternoon, Brazil versus Chile. Leo likes soccer, but unlike his brothers, he prefers baseball. Best of all, he likes riding his bike. He pedals hard past the chain-link fence of his school, Most Precious Blood Elementary, MPB they all call it, and the hot, tarred blacktop where he will be having recess again in a few short days. He whizzes past Most Precious Blood Church and the white sign that advertises Wednesday night bingo in the parish hall next door. His grandmother is a regular. She wins, but not big, not enough to buy him a new bike, which he wants more than anything else, which he covets. He doesn't covet anyone else's bike, just a Trek he has seen advertised in a magazine, but he knows that wanting things and praying for them is bad. Greed, the MPB sisters say, is a sin. Not a mortal one like killing, but a venial one, a misdemeanor. Leo tries to avoid wanting the bike outright because he doesn't like to disappoint the sisters at MPB, but worst of all, he doesn't like disappointing his mother. His mother tells him he is her pride and joy, the one born in America. Does he know how lucky he is to be living in a country where his father can get decent work and he and his brothers can go to good schools? He must thank God for America, his mother tells him. The American boy doesn't know any other country. He hears the stories and he thinks he is the luckiest of all not to know anything but America, this city, this neighborhood where he goes to school and plays baseball, this land of shiny bicycles. At night when he is saying his prayers, always thanking God for America, Leo slips and tries to make deals about how he will help his mother and how he will do all his homework if he only could get that Trek for his birthday. His birthday isn't for weeks, but he is thinking about it now, riding past the library, past the empty Little League field with the backstop halfway torn down, past the mechanic shop where Mickey, his next-door neighbor, works part-time. Mickey is almost a friend. He's much older, but he helps Leo with his bike, lubes the chain for him, or replaces it outright like he did at the beginning of summer. Leo is thinking of his birthday and how much he would like that Trek to ride to school and show his friends. He won't even mind the helmet his mother makes him wear. He won't complain about the helmet. He promises God. So when Leo coasts down the sidewalk toward his grandmother's house, a white triple-decker surrounded by a chain-link fence, and Mickey is waiting, sitting in the passenger seat of a car alongside the curb, engine still running, Leo is only thinking of his Trek, seeing himself on the first day of school, riding to MPB on the shiny bike. He isn't thinking how strange it is that Mickey is here waiting for him. Mickey calls Leo out the car window and tells him to hop in. In the driver's seat, a man Leo doesn't recognize flicks his cigarette butt onto the sidewalk, where it lands next to Leo's sneaker. Mickey says he's found the bike. He will buy it if it's the one Leo wants. Mickey can't remember if it's a Trek or not. He thinks it is. It'll just take a second. He's seen the bike in a shop downtown, and it isn't too expensive. If they go right now, if Leo will just get in the car, and it'll just take a minute, his grandmother won't even know he's gone. She doesn't even know he's here yet. Then Mickey'll know whether or not it's the bike to buy for Leo's birthday. They'll bring him right back, they promise. So his grandmother won't worry. They put his Schwinn in the trunk. If she sees the bike lying in the yard, we don't want her wondering where you are, do we? Mickey says. Leo agrees and climbs in the back seat. Mickey's friend, the driver, smiles in the rearview mirror. You like bikes, huh? This is too good to be true. This is maybe some crazy dream.
Patricia, I think that opening is fabulous. And it starts.
Thank you.
It starts with the first paragraph. And the line, the city holds its breath, made me hold my breath because I thought it was so beautiful, so poetic. Let's talk about writing.
Okay.
You started working on this story at a novel workshop at VCU. How long ago?
How long did this take? A long time ago. So I got my MFA in 2001. And the novel workshop was actually the year after I finished because for some reason they hadn't been able to offer it when I was there. Even though I had finished my MFA, Tom DeHaven let me take this workshop. And so the seeds of the novel started then. But as you mentioned before, I also teach. I'm not great at multitasking, or I've become much better at multitasking. But I would sort of work on it and put it down and work on it and put it down. And, you know, it changed, too, over the course of these years that I've been working on it. I did originally think it was going to focus more on a family and how homophobia breaks apart this family.
Okay.
And then it shifted, really, to the town, which became more interesting to me. And, you know, it's funny, I teach American literature, so I also teach The Scarlet Letter, which I think was also in my brain a great deal when I started shifting this more towards what effect this homophobia has on the whole town.
So many revisions.
Many revisions.
Let's talk about, when did you know you wanted to be a writer? What was your aha moment?
I think I've known my whole life. I mean, I think as a kid, I was always making up stories all the time. I always tell the story, when I was in sixth grade, we all had to take French at my school, which is maybe where my love of French came from, I don't know. I used to make up stories, but if I didn't know, I would just put the words in English that I didn't know. But I've been doing this my whole life, and as an adult, I've been, I would say, working on craft pretty steadily my whole adult life, for sure.
Talk about how the writing community here has helped you.
Oh, it's been such a gift. I can't even say enough about that. Between VCU and everybody at VCU and certainly James River Writers, it's been an enormous gift to be able to go to things like the writing show, go to the annual conferences, just meeting other working writers. There are so many in Richmond who offer all kinds of support and advice. And I think one of the things that's hard about being a writer and maybe about being an artist of any kind is that when you're growing up, or at least when I was growing up, I didn't really imagine that that could be me, right? That I didn't have a role model necessarily for how to be a writer. I mean, I had the books I loved, of course, but I didn't think, oh, someday that could be me. So once you tap into something like James River Writers, for example, and you look around and see all these people who are writing and living and writing all kinds of books and all kinds of things, articles and essays and journalism and all kinds of work, and you start to imagine, oh, this can be me, that's invaluable.
So what are you working on next?
Working on another novel. It's in the pretty early stages. I've got, I think, my two main characters, two women again, but from very different worlds. I had spent a year living in Senegal in West Africa, and one of my main characters, her name is Fatou Njai, And she, this isn't really giving anything away. This is the opening scene of the book, but she steps on a landmine as she's coming back to into the village from the well. And she's going to be sent to Boston to recuperate, to get a prosthetic leg. And she's going to cross paths with an American woman who, as it turns out, has a part. She's an engineer, and her firm manufactures, I think it's the timer, in these landmines.
Wow. Do you have a working title?
Right now I'm calling it The Girl from Casamance, but I'm a little nervous about the repeat of girl in my title, but that's how it is in my brain right now. I'm sure it might change over time.
I look forward to reading that. Before we end, is there any advice you'd like to share with aspiring writers?
First of all, do it. Don't give up on that dream. If you want to write, then you just write. I think your stories, I teach young people who want to be writers, and I tell them, we need your stories. We need all of your stories. And so keep writing, and also really, really keep reading. There's no substitute for reading and knowing what's out there and knowing what you love and the kinds of stories that you like to tell.
What's been the reaction from your students who read your book?
Some of them have told me they've loved it. Some of them haven't said so much, but they usually enjoy when I read it out loud. It's a kind of a hard story sometimes to read to my students because it does talk about, you know, Deirdre is accused of having an inappropriate relationship with a student, which she doesn't have, but she's accused of that. You know, some of those sections are a little rough for me to read out loud to the kids, but I've shared so much of my work with them and my process with them. They've been great cheerleaders for me, so.
Well, I'm a cheerleader too, Patricia. Thank you for stopping by.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It was wonderful.